the evening edition with Aiman and Chuck. And before we move on to our next story about the resignation of the Education Minister, Dr. Mazli Malik, we'll just be going through some of the messages that you sent to us regarding our story from the 5 o'clock hour, which is about punctuality, or impunctuality rather, and why people do it and how to overcome it. And we have a message here from John Ong.
So, John says the reasons why people are late boils down to the lack of etiquette and the lack of importance, because in the end, we would not be late for the critical business negotiation or that first date with our crush. Yeah, there's just some truth in that for sure. If someone is late to meet you, says John, you're just not important enough, and that person just doesn't care.
And that brings us back to the idea of, you know, respecting the other person and respecting the other person's time. Yes, there is. To an extent, I do agree with John. I think that when it comes to like high stakes kind of situations, right, job interviews or first date, as John says, we do want to make a good first impression. We don't want to disappoint the other person, because there will be ramifications from it, I would say. But when it comes to friends, I don't know, for me,
relax lah.
Yeah, I think people are more lenient when it comes to friends, because they know that the ramifications isn't so bad, really. Like, oh, you come late, okay, maybe I'm annoyed with you, but it's not like we're going to break out of friendship or whatever. Whereas when it comes to job interviews, first dates, if you come late, if you make a bad first impression, then that's it. That's the end of it.
Yeah, so I think it also depends on who you're seeing. So some people, you know they're going to be late. So you go like, oh, okay, you know, it's okay if I'm a little bit late as well. Whereas the people that you know are going to be quite, let's say, disappointed with you if you are late, then I would at least make a little bit more effort lah.
And we have a message from Sylvester as well, who says, I'm normally punctual, sometimes earlier, especially when it comes to professional settings. I'm a bit more lenient when it's a social setting with a margin of about 15 minutes, and that the other party communicates that to me as well. Personally, it's a self-respect thing and also respecting others' time. And one thing that is mentioned by Sylvester here is communication. So if you let the other person know in advance that you might be late, I think that even maybe in professional settings, that might be helpful as well. Just to inform that, you know, I'm in an unexpected traffic jam. I might be coming in maybe 10 minutes late or something. I don't know, maybe that can sort of like mitigate the like disappointment from the other side.
I think expectation management is always a good thing. So you're just telling the person like, oh, I'll be there in 10 minutes. It's a lot more comforting than, hey, when is he going to come?
You know? Yeah, like, right. Like, you leave them clueless, right? Don't know what's happening to you, if you're going to come or not. So if you have any other thoughts or messages you want to share with us regarding the issue of impunctuality, why people do it, how do we deal with it? How can we encourage people to be more punctual and change our whole like Malaysian timing mindset? You can call us at 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. And now we're going to move to our next story, because as you may have heard, the Education Minister, Dr. Mazli Malik, has resigned from his post. And this was announced about an hour and a half ago. And this resignation comes after about 20 months in which he seemed to be in the, I guess, center of heated conversation, I would say, from the public about his policies.
Yeah, so we've been pressing the F5 key since the rumor started circulating around 2:30 today. Apparently he had a meeting with Prime Minister Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad as well. And in the end, the press conference was held at about, like, I think 4:30. And then we all basically went, like, well, you know, we're talking about punctuality, so we actually had to rush to do the story.
Yeah, so like during the press conference that was announced, Dr. Mazli listed out the ministry's achievements while he was in charge. And he said that despite the successes, he continued to be criticized by the public over some issues that were played up. And he added that, I believe I've placed a foundation and a clear framework for the ministry to follow. My decision to resign will not be an end, but the start of a new dawn. So, yeah, I mean, whenever people talk about education policies, right, I think there is a lot of pressure on whoever is the minister to deliver on results. The education ministry is, of course, usually every time a budget announcement is made, it's the ministry that has the biggest budget allocation. So the stakes are high. People expect immediate results, I would say. People have been talking about reforms in the education system, making the education system better to unite Malaysians and to provide a better quality of education. So I would say that whenever anyone is in charge of the education portfolio, they will always be under pressure because of the magnitude of responsibility placed under them.
Yeah, so there's, I think, two things in play here. The first one is that, you know, everybody can relate to what they want their children, what kind of future they want for their children. And education is a big, big part of that, right? Mm-hmm. And the other one is also, like, there was a stat recently where they said that the number of local students in international colleges outnumbered the number of international students. So mm-hmm. there's a certain feeling of a lack of faith in our current education system. And of course, you know, Dr. Masli was brought in with the new government and all that. And so I understand there was a lot of pressure on him.
And I mean, to be fair to him, he did introduce policies that I thought were pretty good. I agreed with the free breakfast program for kids in school. I thought that was good in terms of making sure that students can have a nutritious breakfast every day, no matter what background they come from. But of course, there have been some policies where people did criticize a lot. Started off with the whole black shoes issue, which some people felt was not really a priority.
Yeah,
didn't really necessitate the, like, in terms of the whole picture of like education reform, right? So I think that those kind of policies attracted criticism from the public and didn't really set a good foundation for the rest of his tenure as education minister.
Yeah, and then there was the hotel swimming pool one as well. Mm. And then also there was the one that we talked about a month ago, which was joining streams of arts and science. I think we had a lot of callers coming in and saying that actually that was a good thing. Mm. So, you know, there are good and bad, just like any other minister.
Yeah, but either way, in the end, we know now that, you know, well, he has resigned. I'm like speculating that the pressure got to him, but I don't know. It's a shame, but it would be interesting to see how the developments will emerge moving forward, right? What policies would the future education minister pursue? What direction will we be heading towards in the future? And now on the line, we have Nathaniel Tan, who is the communications consultant as well as a columnist who closely observes issues relating to education. Nathaniel, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you, sir.
So first off, may I ask you, in light of his resignation, I think we should talk about the public perception of Masli first. How do you think this played into today's announcement?
To be quite frank, I think if I wanted to gain personal popularity, I'd probably jump on the bandwagon and go on a tirade about what a terrible minister Dr. Masli was. I think public sentiment among, say, English speakers, urbanized, non-Malays, has generally been quite negative for some time now. That certainly would have played into the resignation, of course. The more interesting question, of course, is whether or not this bad perception is justified. I think I'm going to buck the trend a little bit and say the answer leans a bit more towards no than towards yes. I think Dr. Masli is a good example of a good person being thrown into the system, who ends up being shaped by the system rather than shaping the system. Now, the most relevant aspect of that system here, I think, is basically the politicization of governance. In Malaysia, ministers often over-prioritize political considerations when it comes to making government policy. Instead of thinking what's best for the country, they often think about what's best for their political careers, or they cave to pressure to do things that would benefit themselves or their party. Political considerations here don't just mean inter-coalition considerations like between the government and opposition, but also intra-coalition and intra-party considerations. So if you get sucked into a party like Bersatu, maybe you start getting real interested in policies that will make you look more Malay than UMNO, or more Islam than PAS, more Muslim than PAS. No, I mean, I think that's the only logical explanation as to why the Education Ministry would seek to replace the existing standard 5 syllabus, which teaches Jawi alongside Chinese and Tamil calligraphy with a syllabus that teaches only Jawi. So this politicization of governments, I think, is really the core problem. And if we don't address this, I think changing ministers and so on is really not going to achieve half as much as some of us think it will.
Right. And Nathaniel, I actually want to touch on something that you said just now, which is that the public perception of Masli, you mentioned about the English-speaking side of the audience, right? So what about the other sides? Like, what were their perceptions of Masli?
I think this is a little bit harder to say. I mean, I think some of the more conservative, more right-wing, of course, will may see him a little bit as a champion of, like, you know, trying to make the syllabus a little bit more Malay, a little bit more Muslim, maybe. And I don't think that answer is so clear and so apparent as for the other group of people.
And why do you think he's been such a polarizing figure throughout his tenure as education minister?
I think many people who dislike Dr. Masli think of him as an overzealous Islamist or an oddball with a penchant for focusing on very arbitrary things. I think those who know him well or who have heard him speak in person tend to have a very different impression. In person, I think you can see his true passion for education and a core compassion that, you know, drives his work. My friend Hilman was a student at UIA, and he describes Dr. Mazli as a very progressive guy. I think he mentioned that Dr. Mazli once said in class that if you were to join a political party, it'd be DAP. No, I think I can quite confidently say that despite some of the perception, he really wasn't some zealot whose life goal was to Islamicize the country. Not even close, I think. And I think by and large, he was a guy that really meant well. I guess I'm just not sure whether he managed to keep from being tossed and thrown about by a rather dysfunctional political system. Well, speaking of DAP and dysfunction, I think one of the most dangerous fallouts to today's announcement is this possible perception that Dr. Mazli was forced out by non-Malay groups, whether it's like political organizations or civil society organizations. If this becomes a narrative, then the hardline Malay groups are going to make a real big fuss about it, and this is going to exacerbate racial tensions that are already riding really high.
Right, okay, so let's move away from the perceptions for a bit and talk about the actual policies, okay? So I feel like, combining streams was quite popular. Others, like the hotel swimming pool ones, I don't know whether that was a soundbite or not. Maybe you can just tell us, like, just recap kind of like which of these policies were probably the most talked about and the most contentious.
Yeah, I can't claim to have a very good handle of, you know, his policies as a whole. As a communications consultant, I can, of course, speak a little bit about those that tended to grab the headlines. You know, you guys have already mentioned twice, you know, black and white shoes and swimming pools, right? You know, the reason that these things stand out, of course, is because they capture the imagination, right? You know, it's something you can easily latch onto. You know, I think I was there at the Sina Harian Forum in Shah Alam where I think he first spoke about the black shoes. And there and then, the crowd, they actually loved it. They were like, oh, broke out into applause. Everyone's very excited. But when it got into the media, the perception seemed to be changing shoe color. You know, this is a guy who's got his priorities all wrong, you know. Right. I mean, he's a guy that tends to shoot from the hip a little bit. You know, on one hand, it's like it shows his sincerity. It's just like whatever he's thinking in his head, he'll kind of like speak out a little bit in a way. But of course, there's a plus and minus to that. So I think having a coherent, long-term and well-thought-out communication strategy really is vital for any ministry. If not, you'll find that a lot of your good policies get drowned out by things like black shoes and swimming pools, you know? I mean, another thing I remember well about Dr. Mazli is his commitment to special needs education. I think he really went all out to do more for that community, and I think that definitely deserves credit.
So, like, how would someone actually avoid getting these kind of, you know, sound nuggets, almost preyed on by the media and made into something bigger than that, what they actually said?
I mean, I think, you know, the sort of like bigger picture answer to that question is that the government of today, right, you know, Tun Mahathir's government, his approach to communications and national narrative and things like that is a little bit of a 80s kind of approach. You know, back then, you know, whatever you want the people to think, you just tell RTM and tell TV3 and the next day that's what people are talking about, right, you know. But today it's really different, you know. It's really, you have to really think out what is your narrative, what kind of story do you want to tell, what do you want to be remembered for, and what is the impression that you want to create in the minds of people. You know, if you don't put a lot of thought into this and do it on a, you know, in a professional way, you know, you kind of just get bounced about, you know. And I think politics today is really so much more about perception than it used to be.
You know, I'm wondering, in light of this, right, what lessons can be learned here for future, I guess, technocrats who may be interested in getting involved in government administration? Like, what can we learn from this?
Well, I mean, I think what we are obviously seeing is that technocrats don't get elected as ministers. You know, I mean, I think it's quite good that Dr. Mazli is at least an academic, you know, so that, you know, he's a better suit from the job than for, you know, many other ministers, you know. And I certainly think he's far from the least qualified minister for his position. You know, his performance maybe is, you know, someone at the bottom quadrant kind of thing because of, you know, all these communication gaps and things like that. But, I think it would be great if we had more technocrats who are in decision-making positions. Then we don't have that kind of politicization of governments that I was talking about earlier, you know. But so this is the problem, yeah.
And do you think this, the experience of Dr. Mazli, would hinder technocrats from getting involved in government?
I don't think so. I mean, I think what hinders technocrats from getting the governance is the way that our system works. You know, it's sort of like a Westminster system where you kind of reward high-ranking politicians with ministries. That's very different from the American system. Not that that's perfect, but in the American system, you know, the cabinet is appointed by expertise. The Secretary of Education or Transport, whatever, is chosen more or less as a civil servant kind of thing, as someone who's an expert in that, not an elected representative. Those are two very different things. So if you have an elected representative, then the guy in there who's running the ministry runs it according to what he thinks is best for his party, for sometimes for his own personal political career. And I think this really, really is at the root of a large number of problems that we have in Malaysian politics.
Right. Okay. And then about the public, what do you think they're going to respond? How do you think they're going to respond to this resignation?
Well, I mean, to be quite frank, I'm sure I'm already, you know, on the various WhatsApp groups where people basically already going ding dong, the witch is dead, you know. I mean, some people will be delighted, but like I said, the flip side is that, you know, some people may perceive this as like, oh, you see, the non-Malays are bullying the guy who was trying to stand up for Jawi and so on, and it's going to be quite a mess. Like, I think that tension will get even worse, and that's not a good development. I mean, if you want to go all conspiracy theory about it, it's like, oh, maybe this is what the Prime Minister wants, and what I mean, but that's a whole other can of worms.
Yeah, but based on what you're saying, right, so it's like people already have this perception of Mazli not being the right person for the role. Does that kind of affect his ability to do the role? Because, I mean, you want a minister that kind of endears that kind of faith in the public.
I mean, I think, you know, if you try and imagine how Dr. Mazli is feeling today, you know, I mean, I'm sure a large part is a bit unhappy and sad, and, you know, that it all ends this way. But I'm sure another part is great relief, like, you know. Mm. I mean, I think after a while, people came to look at him as a guy that can't do right. And again, this is public perception, and this is the communications game and warfare that exists today. You know, it's all about being able to maintain a certain amount of like consistency. And, you know, after a while, if you get settled on with too many black shoes, swimming pools, it really just starts to, you know, that's what all they see you as. And yeah, of course, it hinders your work, you know. So yeah, it's not really the shakedown that you deserve, but, you know, that's how it rolled out.
Yeah, so actually I was asking, like, does it affect his ability to do his job if like you don't get public buy-in as a minister, just specifically that?
Well, I mean, maybe I'll answer by saying, you know, I think if Dr. Mazli wanted to continue, if he had wanted to, like, okay, let's, you know, take a totally different approach, I think he could have still salvaged some of, you know, the rest of his tenure as a minister and things like that, you know. But I think, I don't know, I mean, of course, for whatever different political consideration, decided it's really just too much, like, you spend too much time arguing over things that, you know, don't really matter. I mean, I think the Jawi issue is really a perfect example of this. You know, it's an issue that, you know, by changing from the Standard 5 syllabus, existing Standard 5 multicultural syllabus, to the current, you know, mono-ethnic Standard 4 syllabus, what do you gain, really? You know, I mean, there's really no big upside to this, you know, but the downsides are so many. So, you know, it becomes, again, I just distract from fundamentals of what an education minister should be doing.
Right, so like picking your battles, basically.
Yes.
So, just one final question, because we have about a minute or two before we have to go to the news. Right. Just looking forward, right, what would you like to see being prioritized by the next education minister?
I think the incoming education minister should really go back to focus on fundamentals. I think one sentiment that's ongoing for a while is that Malaysians would be happy to send their kids to national schools if national schools were of the same standard they were, say, 20 or 30 years ago. So it's back to basics, you know, the quality of teachers, the curriculum, the sort of things. I think if we focus on those and on incentivizing national schools to become as multi-ethnic as they used to be, that'd be really good. You know, and of course, given some of the rumors going around, I think it's worth pointing out that whoever takes the post should have, at the very least, a real degree from a real university. The irony of someone with a fake degree leading education ministry would really just be too much.
Nathaniel, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much, sir. All the best.
That was Nathaniel Tan, columnist and communications consultant. If you have any thoughts about this topic, what do you want to see the next education minister focusing on? You can call us at 7733 2900, WhatsApp 0187898899, or tweet us at BFM Radio, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my, BFM 89.9, the business station.